This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Now, the opening drive.
Seahawks power rankings. Now, usually when people put those together, they're ranking teams 1 through 32. We did it a little bit differently. We ranked the players 1 through 15. Well, it was a little bit more than 15, but if you were going to rank the Seahawks' best players, and that's really the only criteria for it, their very best players, 1 through 15, how would you do it? And I think it's interesting when we've got the results tabulated here because there's tiers of players. I don't think anybody has a dispute over the most valuable, the most important, the best football player on the Seahawks team. It's Russell Wilson, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you were critical of the rest of my list.
Well, I don't know about the rest of it, because I like to pick number two you had as well, which was Bobby Wagner. And I think in some order, there might be some people that say Bobby Wagner's better at his position than Russell Wilson is at his.
Yeah.
That's a matter of debate. But if you were asked to list Seattle's best football players, one and two, those two, that's going to be Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner, right? They're right. The two best players on this team.
Yeah, and I think the biggest question is next. Who's number three? But, yeah, I mean, you bring up the point if you want to, for example, Jaron Reed. I mean, he's only going to be available for 10 games. But for me, when I made my list, it's like, who are the best football players on this team? But you're right. If you wanted to say Bobby Wagner's better at his position than Russell is at his, right?
Yes. People would say Bobby Wagner's one of the two best middle linebackers in the league. And I think most people
Keekly still the other guy?
Keekly's the other one.
He's ranked in the top 100. It was after Bobby, though.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby was what, number 7 or 8 or something like that?
Yeah, Bobby's considered, I think, by most people now to be the best middle linebacker in the game right
now. Yeah, I think he's number one right now. But Russell's in the top three, I believe. I think it's, and somebody else had that on their list, but, Drew Brees, Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson.
You have Russell Wilson at number three?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who do you have number three on this top 15 Seahawks list?
Mine is Dwayne Brown. I think Dwayne Brown's the best football player, the next best football player. And there's a lot of other choices there. But what he does at his position, I was looking at his pads today. He has actually pretty big shoulder pads. You compare him to, especially Michael Bennett. But just how steady he is. And I watched on a run in Minnesota, he blocked Everson Griffin. And it was just perfect. I mean, I compare him to Walter Jones, and he's not as dominant as Walter Jones, not quite, but he's pretty close. And having a left tackle that you don't have to worry about, it's one of those positions you don't have to worry about. In my mind, there's three positions: the kicker, the left tackle, and then you want to have a corner that can shut people down and not have to worry about getting beat over the top. And those are three tough positions. But yeah, to me, I just think Dwayne Brown, as far as importance, how professional he is, have you ever seen him lunge or struggle to make a block? I mean, he is just always balanced, and he's just, even though what he does is not flying around the field making plays, he's just so steady at what he does.
And Dwayne Brown does come in third on the balloting. It was
you two?
Split. I had him fourth, and Jessamine also had him fourth. And Jim and Dave both had him third. So he came in, on the average of our ballots, he came in as the third best football player on the Seahawks roster.
Who was you guys third?
Tyler Lockett.
Yeah.
That was who I put in is the third best player, and that was Jessamine's as well. So pretty much all of us had, in some order, that Dwayne Brown was either the third or the fourth best, and then Tyler Lockett was there. I think Lockett, for me, is the third best because of what he did last year. I don't know if we give enough credit for, we know that there aren't that many passes that get thrown in this offense. That you're not going to have, I guess, there was one year Doug Baldwin had more than 90 catches, but that's the exception rather than the rule. And they got back to running the ball. Tyler Lockett is incredibly efficient while also being a top-tier deep threat. And that's so difficult to do. I think he ended up with more than 50 catches last season. He was only targeted 70 times. The fact that he averaged almost 20 yards a catch while catching that high a percentage of the balls that were thrown his way, it's not just a credit to him, it's a credit to Russell Wilson as well. I think that he is on the short list of the most effective. If there was a stat for slugging percentage, I think you can make an argument for Tyler Lockett being the most efficient receiver in the league.
Could be. Well, Russell Wilson last year, it's pretty well documented, perfect passer rating when he threw to Tyler Lockett. I've got Lockett at number 7. I know we're going down the list here, but if you had a list and you called it the most important players this season, I maybe would put Lockett number 1, because you can't, you have to have a good season from Tyler Lockett. You can't have any injuries to Lockett this year because of the rest of the receiving crew, you know, you have a bunch of question marks there.
You had Chris Carson as the 4th best.
I did. Chris Carson, number 4.
Explain yourself.
Very discouraging, because so do I. Just kidding.
Why would that be discouraging,
it's
Dave?
It's true. Actually,
see, I listen to what you're saying.
Wyman and Moore are in lockstep so far. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, I think
Jim is wise.
Sitting in a tree.
It's going to change at number 5. No, Chris Carson, he's one of the best backs in the league. He rushed for 1,150 yards last year, and this is the year, too, where I just, you know, I look at the difference between Carson and Penny. I know, as you mentioned yesterday, Danny, I know it's supposed to be a 1A and a 1B, but, man, to me it looks like a 1A and a 1Z right now. So I want to see Carson get all the carries, most of them this year. And Dave always makes a good point about Carson, probably his running style, that's not conducive to him playing in 16 games. But I just love seeing that guy run. And well, I want to see, he's that kind of back like Marshawn Lynch, where he's going to wear defenses down, and I think he's going to be more effective the more often he gets the ball. And I just, this whole business of sharing the ball back there, I don't really like it. If you got a back like Chris Carson, just keep feeding him.
Yeah, the only concern is just he takes a beating, as you mentioned. But, yeah, I have him 4th behind Dwayne Brown. And I guess the reason why I'm not discounting Tyler Lockett, but he's in my top 5 because Tyler Lockett's number 5, is just because they don't throw that much. I mean, what's more important? The running game. And, you know, he got 1,151 yards on the ground. Tyler Lockett had 937. So if you just look at those numbers, yeah, Tyler, you're right. Efficiency, I mean, that, and they're not going to throw that much. So I just think Chris Carson is more important. So for me, it goes Russell, Bobby, Dwayne Brown, Chris Carson, and Tyler Lockett.
I ended up ranking Carson 7th. Jessamyn had him as 8th. And my thinking, and this probably ties into the overall devaluation of the running back, where I thought, well, you know what, if Carson were to get hurt, or Carson weren't to have as good a year, they've got Rashad Penny waiting in the wings. And Rashad Penny's a former first-round pick. And I, despite the local wringing of hands over Rashad Penny's trajectory, I still think Rashad Penny is going to be a really good football player for this team.
Why does everybody feel that way? Now, I know I'm on the,
I don't know. I just I do.
No, I know. I'm on the other side of it. But what exactly has Rashad Penny done that makes you feel like, oh, other than, honest to God, if he were a 5th-rounder, would you be saying the same things about Rashad Penny?
Probably not.
That's the thing.
But he's a first-round pick, and the Seahawks are generally pretty good at picking their running backs.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Christian Michael?
How about Marshawn Lynch? Marshawn Lynch was on
his
way out of the league.
They traded for him. They didn't draft him.
Yeah, but that was an identification of talent.
Well, I just don't see why everybody's all excited about Rashad Penny off of what we see. And I know I'm not just basing it on 2 games. Last year, I just didn't feel like, you know, that he looked like a first-round talent to me.
How about when he reversed field against
the
Packers?
Yeah, I know. That always comes up.
How about when he was the best running back on the team in the playoff game against Dallas?
Okay. How about Travis Homer looking better than he did in the game the other night? Travis Homer, I'm looking at this kid going, if I came in here from Mars and didn't know anything about Travis Homer and Rashad Penny, I'd go, who the hell is that kid playing in the 4th quarter? He's a hell of a lot better than the guy I saw earlier getting 6 carries for no yards.
If you came in here from Mars, I wouldn't trust your opinion about football at all.
Travis,
I'd be like,
Homer,
who is going to listen to you? You're from Mars, dude.
How much better was Travis Homer the other night?
He looked better.
Yeah, he did.
He did look better. So there's a little bit of that that's factored in. It's Danny David Moore. This hour is brought to you by Parsons Extreme Golf. We've also got a code word. A code word that we're going to give you away once each hour. It's your chance to win tickets to the August 29th Seahawks preseason game. They're hosting the Raiders. Don't forget, the Seahawks regular season is almost here, and there is nothing like game day at CenturyLink Field. Get your tickets today at Seahawks.com. That code word will be given a little bit later. All right, if we get through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if Chris Carson ranks 5th, because that's where he comes on our balloting, who's the 6th most important Seahawk? Who's the 6th most important Seahawk? And I'd be interested to hear people as they tally their list, because here's where it starts to bounce around and get a little bit weird. On our ballots, it comes out to be Jaron Reed. The Jaron Reed is the 6th best football player on the Seahawks. What's interesting is I think Jim's has a guy that I didn't include in my top 15, and I think I might have made a mistake. Where does Ziggy Ansah fit in all of this. He's got a pretty proven track record. We haven't thought about him all that much, but first let's start with the inclusion. Jaron Reed, how good is he for this team?
He's really good. Double-digit sacks, it's really hard. If you go back and look at the history of NFL football, I mean, double-digit sacks don't come from the inside guys, typically. I mean, every once in a while you get a Aaron Donald or you get a John Randall, but it's not very often. And if you wanted to maybe discount him because you know he's only going to be in 10 games, okay, that's fine. But I'm just looking at it like who's the best football player. And really it's just degree of difficulty. How hard is that to do? It's really hard. It's really hard for Jaron Reed to get 10.5 sacks. And plus he's a pretty good against the run as well. So he's a great football player. I mean, at Alabama, he was the lead dog there. And so he came into a locker room where it was Michael Bennett, Chris Averill, and he wasn't able to really speak up. But Jaron Reed, yeah, I mean, I think what he does, that's what makes him number six for me.
Yeah, well, I have Jaron Reed at number six, and I had Ziggy Ansah at number five. And Ansah, maybe I have a little too
high
there. You
know what? Can we pause just a second?
We found out something today about
Jim. And Dave's ballots are almost identical.
You heard the story, and you'll hear it during Will Disley's interview. Jim also cheats. And so I wouldn't put it past that he was looking over at my list.
I cheated once in my life.
How about today? Did you cheat today by looking at Dave's list?
I didn't look at his list.
You guys are almost exactly alike.
Where's he got Ziggy?
He's got Ziggy. Ziggy is
Ziggy's not in my top 50.
Yeah, Ziggy's 22 on Dave's list.
Why not?
I just don't expect anything from him. And also
nothing.
Well, I have not seen him. Have you seen him?
Yeah, I've seen him. He's not really doing anything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of the things, you know, like I have a different system. Like Michael Dixon to me is not a football player, so he's not in the top 15. He's a great punter.
Michael Dixon, for the record, made it 14th in our balloting.
Well, 14th?
He made it 14th, and Jim has him number 8. Jim's the only one. Jim's the only one that put the punter in the top 10, but he put Michael Dixon 8.
See, I was going to have him number 9, and then I thought, wait a minute. Dave was with Aaron Levine on the sideline at Pop Keeney Stadium, and he told me about how he was dropping the balls and everything.
That was at CenturyLink, but yeah.
Was at CenturyLink? Okay. Dixon at number 8? And where do you have him, Dave? He's not even in your top 15?
Number 17.
Number 17.
Now, here would be the argument over Dixon, because it's not about how good he is. I think we all recognize that he's one of the two or three best punters in the league. He was the best last year. But what's the marginal utility? I think that's the economist phrase of the difference between the Michael Dixon and the next best guy you could get to do that job. What's the difference there compared to the difference between Jaron Reed and the next best guy you can get to do the defensive tackle job? That's the idea of value, right? Is not just how good he is, but how good he is in comparison to other people that are, how important that is viability of this job.
Well, he has no backup.
Yes.
Well, I didn't factor whatever you just said into my list. I just looked at him and I thought, man, that kid's a good punter. I wasn't like going, well, let's see, Michael Dixon, you know, if you had John Ryan there, what would be the difference in the market value?
No, marginal utility.
Whatever. I wasn't thinking that. That kid, you know what I love about Michael Dixon, I was even thinking about, with the pass interference rules this year, I just think more and more, again, and I've been saying this for a couple of years, so I'll just repeat myself because there might be new listeners out there. Just throw it deep. Throw it deep on third and long. Throw it deep. And if you don't get it, then you still have Michael Dixon who can just boot the heck out of the ball. And it, you know, this stuff with getting field position, with, you know, checking down for a gain of 6 or 7, you see the punt team trot out there. You don't need to do that with Dixon because he can kick it 60 yards if need be.
Well, part of his formula, too, is the coverage. I mean, you saw the hit by Ugo Amadi. I mean, and that was really what happened last year. I mean, and I'm not saying he's not a good kicker, because like I said, I just can't believe the things he can do. Making the ball spin like a kickoff, except backwards, so it backs up. And I mean, he's basically like a golfer that, you know, hits a wedge shot and sucks it back somehow.
Do you think he's sitting there going, bite, bite, bite? Is that what you say?
He is. You know, the golf show will be back Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, by the way. We'll be talking about the Tour Championship.
We have a flare-up at the golf show.
Yeah. Xander Schauffele, he had a good round today.
Golf show flared up on Sunday. Everybody be warned.
He overtook Justin Thomas there at Eastlake.
Dave.
Fascinating.
Backing up on the punter and his ability to spin it like a kickoff and get it to bite.
But his coverage, too. I mean, he's had great coverage. They're probably the best coverage team in the NFL. I mean, Akeem King, and last year it was Justin Coleman. Now we see Ugo Amadi. Ugo Amadi, you know, that tackle he made in Minnesota. It wasn't just the tackle. His release, he had two guys over the top of him, and he split right down the middle of them. He put a little move, juked one guy. I mean, there's a serious talent in that. And, you know, but Dixon is hitting it at the right spot, and it's a coordination of the two, the coverage and the kick, because you can outkick your coverage, and he doesn't do that. Because I think he can kick it a lot farther than he does sometimes. So, yeah, but I just, I mean, if they didn't have him, it makes it a lot easier, but I'm not sure that I would substitute any of the guys in the top 15 for him.
Next,
if somebody's going to get hurt, right?
If Jaron Reed is number 6, then it goes to Bradley McDougal, number 7. And it gets fairly right in the between. Jessamine had him as high as 5. Jim had him at 10. Dave and I both had him sandwiched in there. Number 8. Here's where we get a little bit of divergence. KJ Wright comes in 8th, in large part because Jim did not rank KJ Wright among his top 15.
How stupid not to have KJ Wright in your top 15.
It's just different.
I thought
judging by your rankings, you think Michael Dixon is twice as good a football player as KJ Wright. Dixon 8, and you've got KJ at 16.
I do. At this, well, if you want to look at it that way, fine. But yeah, that's fine. I think Dixon's a better player right now than KJ Wright is at this point in his career.
Number 9.
By the way, 206 corrected me. You're right. Nico Thorpe also on coverage, too.
Ooh.
Didn't mention him.
Yeah, Nico Thorpe's a heck of a player.
Well, I had those two flip-flopped, KJ Wright and Bradley McDougal. But, you know, I just think KJ, because he didn't play a lot last year, he is kind of like Dwayne Brown in his steadiness.
Next guy I have is Kendricks. Kendricks comes in 9th. I had him the highest. I ranked him the 5th best Seahawk because I really like Michael Kendricks. I'm thinking about getting one of his jerseys.
Are you?
Yeah, absolutely I am.
Why is that, Danny?
Well, because...
One with stripes, orange, blue,
a Seahawks
green
jersey, because he's going to be playing in all 16 games for the Seahawks this season.
We'll see.
In part because I think this has all been much ado about nothing. I think he was unfairly penalized last year for what was just, just cutting a little corners. Cut some corners in some of his approach to his financial affairs previously.
I put that aside, though. I had him at number 9.
You did. That is true, and everybody had him there. Rounding out the top 10, and this, I think we have a firm evidence of Jim Moore's bias. Will Dissly is number 10, and that comes in spite of Jim Moore ranking him 19th.
Oh, really?
Yeah, by far the lowest of anyone.
Okay.
Anti-Husky bias.
No, it has nothing to do, and we talked to Will Dissly today, and we'll be playing that interview at 5 o'clock. Has nothing to do with any of that. How many games has he played?
4.
He's played 4.
And he's looked awesome in them.
He has.
Tremendous.
He's
coming
back.
He was the leading receiver through like 7 games after having played 4.
Well, thank you, Jess.
You're welcome.
He's also coming back from a patellar tendon injury. And even though he's young, we know from history tells us that patellar tendon injuries are tough to come back from. And so that's why I didn't rank him in the top 15, because I don't necessarily feel like he's going to come back and be gangbusters right away.
He's tough, too.
If we only listened to history, Jim, we would just assume the Cougs would never win another Apple Cup. Sometimes the past doesn't repeat itself.
You know what? We won in 2012, okay? We did. We won. Do you remember that? Do you remember that? I vaguely do now. It will happen again.
Tony Pollet.
Tony Pollet.
90-yard interception return.
Who was your receiver that caught
him, setting up a winning touchdown
anyway
in overtime.
Who was that guy that caught him, that receiver?
Was it Nickens? Nickens that ran him down?
I can't remember.
It is Danny, Dave, and Moore. It's time for us to take 2.
Take 2. Speaking of the Huskies, neither them nor the Cougs have officially named a starting quarterback.
This isn't a surprise. I think everyone that follows the University of Washington, I think this is much ado over nothing. I think Jacob Eason's going to be the starter. I've thought from the beginning that any discussion about Haener beating him out is absurd.
Is Haener any good?
Haener, from what I've seen, and he hasn't played all that much, yeah, I think he's got a good knack for the offense. He's not big, and he certainly looked like he was in over his head when he was thrown into that Cal game and threw the pick 6. He looked bad in that game. He had played earlier in the year. If it was the game against Eastern, it was whoever they opened up with, the lesser-level school. He looked pretty good when he came in. This is Jacob Eason's job. I would assume that. And I guess I'm under the assumption that Gage Gabrud is going to be the Cougs starter. Is that not accurate?
That's not accurate.
Really?
Anthony Gordon. Mike Leach, when he talked to reporters, I think it was on Sunday, said that Gordon, if they had a game today, he'd be starting. And
do you buy that? Because
yeah, I buy that. Jess, you've got a better handle on what's going on over there. But Brock was talking about this morning. He's got more arm strength than Gubrud, and it feels like Leach likes him because he just doesn't overthink things.
Yeah, Gordon throws a prettier ball. It's easier to catch, from what I've heard from my crimson and gray sources. And I think that only bodes well for the strength of the team. If Gubrud is not the guy, then Anthony Gordon is that much better. It's not that the Gubrud doesn't have what it takes, because we've seen his body of work, and he's an outstanding quarterback. It's one of those things where there's a lot of talent hanging around. You don't know what's waiting in the wings until it gets on the field.
I would like to say, I don't trust quarterbacks when they talk about other quarterbacks in competitions. Like, I think Brock is a very bad... Brock knows a ton about the game. He's forgotten more about football than I'll ever know, except when he starts talking about quarterback competitions. And then they start making it sound like, oh, they're choosing between two different vintages of wine and how difficult the selection is. And it's like, no, come on. Everybody that's been watching the Huskies has assumed that Jacob Eason, and I just didn't listen to any of the conversation about whether or not it's going to be Hayner or him. All of this, the parsing and Brock talking about arm strength and all...
Do you buy any of that?
Brock's a Husky. He's just trying to help them with the competition.
He's trying to, like, carry their water for the PR image of it.
Well, I mean, yeah. Or, you know, encourage the quarterbacks to continue to compete, because that breeds the best.
Or try to get some motivation imparted upon Jacob Eason, because the coaches would like that as well.
Well, I don't really care what's going on with your school, but I just think it's going to be fun with Anthony Gordon, because if he's better than Gage Gubrud, because he came in there, Gubrud, and remember a couple years ago, he was thrown to Cooper Kupp and he beat the Cougs. And so everybody thought, well, it's going to be Gubrud, and he's going to be the next coming of Gardner Minshew. But if Gordon is better than Gubrud, I think that bodes well for the Cougs.
Joel McHale, local actor, former Husky tight end, will be calling the Seahawks game alongside Steve Rabel this weekend while Wyman moves over to TV.
Yeah, it could be an improvement over the guy that's going over to TV. Anyway.
You're going to the TV side?
Yeah, I'm on the TV side, Danny.
Love it when you say that you're on the TV side.
Takes priority during the preseason.
Coming back from the TV side.
I like Joel McHale.
You remember when he told us about being on the crew team and how they hazed the different rowers?
I don't.
He called in and he talked about how apparently if no one comes to watch your competitions, you make up for it by having humiliating rituals that you subject the freshmen to. It's very funny.
I don't remember.
We're
going
to talk to him tomorrow. He will be on the show.
Her. Yeah, he lives in Hollywood, right? He's down in
Los Angeles.
Yeah. Mercer Island High School graduate.
Yes, Dave is from the land of the silver screen.
That's right. It's in Hollywood.
Down there with the Hollywood tours. Lifestyles of the rich and famous. Joel McHale. Talk soup.
What was talk soup? Was that when they go back and... What was that about? Would they just show clips, kind of like TMZ or something?
They would debate minestrone versus chicken noodle.
That's
come on,
true.
Let's go talk soup.
That's not true, Danny.
Got Ryan Divish. He joins us next.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
it's Danny, Dave, and more. Streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
I warned you. Told you we were going to give out a code word. I think it's a good time to do that. Really might be. Point out that here's your opportunity to text in. Head to 710sports.com /win right now. That's 710sports.com/win. Enter the word win by the end of our show to be entered to win two tickets to the August 29th Seahawks preseason game against the Raiders. Remember, this code word will expire when our show ends today. Details and rules, 710sports.com/win. It's fun to go through. Apparently, I should stick to sports because my definition of marginal utility, whatever I was talking about, was completely screwed up.
You sure?
Yes. Marginal utility is the satisfaction you will gain from consuming another unit of a specific good or service. So the marginal utility of a second pizza, that second pizza might not be as satisfying or as good as the first pizza because you'll end up hating yourself over eating it. Mm-hmm. The marginal utility generally refers to the declining satisfaction you experience the more you consume or use a specific good or service. Has nothing to do with what I was alleging.
And what were you saying it was?
I was saying it was the difference between, like, basically win over replacement, or
it was over Dixon and, like, John Ryan.
The difference between Dixon and the next best punter that they could be able to contact. Again, just an example of how I should stick to sports. We've got with us right now the beat writer covering the Tacoma Rainiers. That's Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times. Well, no, he also covers the Seattle Mariners. Ryan, what's up?
Not much. What's going on?
I saw you were down in Tacoma for Felix's last start. Was that on Monday? Would you just want to stick close so you could go to the poodle dog afterwards?
The poodle dog's in Fife. I wouldn't go there. We didn't travel to the Tampa portion of that road trip. I was in Detroit and Toronto, and for some reason they wanted me to skip a series on that, but they didn't want me to skip Detroit, which everyone would want to skip Detroit. So I was back home. I got back home. I had kind of a crazy travel day, but figured I could go see Felix at Cheney Stadium since it's about, 5 minutes from my apartment. So I went over there and watched him pitch, and I figured as long as he didn't get hurt in there, he would be making that start on Saturday.
What do you expect from him Saturday?
Not a lot, honestly. He's made, four starts on this rehab stint. He's been out for 80-some games. I think the adrenaline will be high for him. I think he'll be very fired up, but I don't know that he has the stamina right now or probably just the innings of math to be, on his game. You never know. I mean, a guy that's been as good as he is can kind of rise to the occasion. I think it'll be helped because the Blue Jays just aren't very good. They'll have Vlad Guerrero and Bichette, Cavan Biggio, and those guys are talented, but for the rest of the lineup, isn't that great. So he could probably, take advantage of how aggressive those kids are and maybe get through it, but I don't expect him to go seven innings or anything like that.
Hey, Ryan, so since, late part of July, 21st, 22nd, Kyle Seager just on fire, 11 home runs, he's batting .337. Where are you with him? Because I know people are saying, well, how come he can't do that when it counts, and then he started off kind of slow, but talk about your feelings about Kyle Seager in the future.
Yeah, I mean, he has been traditionally a slow starter his entire career. April and May, never been good. And obviously he started this year in basically the end of May and beginning of June, and he was off to a slow start. I felt like he kind of rushed back in the sense that he only played about 5 rehab games and then came off the DL right when he was eligible. That's not enough games really to kind of develop your rhythm and timing at the plate. And I think that affected him as the slow start that he came off the hand injury. Then also, he hurt his other hand about, 3 weeks into his return, and that affected him. So I think right now, after the All-Star break, he just finally came back healthy. And he kind of went back to his old swing. He tried to do some different things. I think when you've done all this work in the offseason to get in shape, you try and do some different things because your body's allowing you to do it. But he went back to the swing that he's always had, and what he realized that this new body that he's got, in terms of more flexibility, better strength, less weight, made his old swing even better than it was before. And I think that's kind of what he credits a lot of that with Tim Laker kind of getting him back to that point. I hear the Twitter memes and everything about Seager only doing it when it doesn't count. Well, at no point has this season counted. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to 2016 when he hit 30 homers and had 99 RBIs and had an OPS over 900, they were in it till the very last day. And he basically carried him for the entire season. So it's just like people have this kind of, they have a mindset about Seager and who he is. And, basically he has underperformed the last 2 years. And a lot of fans have turned on him. He makes a lot of money. He hasn't produced at the level that they've desired. So, they kind of come up with a lot of these ideas of who he is or isn't, and he doesn't care or anything like that. When he's got one of the worst tempers on the team, he just doesn't do it out on the field. And it's similar to what we've seen with Felix. That for all that Felix has done for 10 years, when they didn't put anything around him, and the ownership group was criminal in how they handled the situation. These last 4 years have soured fans to the point where they've turned on him. And that's their right. They're fans. They can do whatever the hell they want. I'm not telling them how to be fans because I'm not one of them. But it is kind of amusing when you look on Twitter and see the reactions to a lot of this stuff. But, then again, Twitter is the downfall of society as you know it.
Hey, Ryan, Friday night we'll see the return of Justice Sheffield and encouraging results. His numbers there at AA Arkansas. But I just wonder, if the ball makes a difference because we know that the AA ball is different than the one in AAA and major leagues. And what are you hearing from pitchers about the ball? We know that the batters must love it, but what about the pitchers?
Yeah, pitchers hate it. I talked to Wade LeBlanc. I'm supposed to talk to him a little bit more. He's going to go on the record. Some of the guys don't want to necessarily go on the record and talk about it, but they've talked about how hard it is, It just seems harder. It's like throwing a pool cue or a cue ball from a pool game. And, you know, the seams don't react. And what they've talked about, and MLB admitted that the resistance on the ball is different. And for pitchers like Wade LeBlanc, what they've found is that because the balls are so different and the seams are different, pitches that they've thrown for their entire lives don't break the way they used to break. Like a year ago, they broke completely different. And they're finding that there's no consistency to the break. That's kind of what, you know, people haven't talked about it maybe around here, but, you know, they point out that Edwin Diaz has struggled. Part of that struggle with Edwin Diaz is because he can't throw that slider that made him so good last year. It's not doing the same thing as it did last year because the ball is different and he isn't able to command it. So basically, he was trying to throw it. It wasn't breaking. It was getting hit. And so he struggled with that. And now he's just only throwing fastballs. I think that's what happened with Sheffield. Some of the breaking stuff and his fastball wasn't reacting the way it normally had with previous baseballs. And so he didn't know how to handle that. And I also think because they were just hitting bomb after bomb in the AAA level, and you're going into places like Albuquerque that are just launching pads, he got afraid to throw the ball in the strike zone. I talked with Darren Brown a little bit about it when I was in Tacoma on Monday. He just said all of his pitchers have gotten afraid to throw the ball in the strike zone because they're so afraid of giving up these homers. And at some point, you can't pitch that way. It takes you out of who you are and what's going to happen. So either way, Justin's going to have to adjust. I mean, there's no going back to Tacoma next year. He's got to figure this out at the big league level, and that's why they brought him up when they did. He needs to pitch up here and figure this stuff out because they got to put him in the rotation next year. They're running, you know, he's a young guy, but they're kind of running out of time on this in terms of getting him big league starts and a basis of big league starts to move forward.
Talking to Ryan Divish here on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. Ryan, you had a really interesting story about Yusei Kikuchi. And that maybe for the first time, Scott Servais showed a little bit of frustration in Kikuchi's approach and that he wouldn't stick with something that they had worked on and changed. How do you feel the franchise, the team feels about Kikuchi's rookie season, his first season here in Seattle?
Yeah, I think they're disappointed a little bit in it because, you know, I think they felt like the results are going to be better. Because if you look at the talent that this kid has, it is apparent. I think they're surprised maybe at how much the transition has been difficult for him. He's talked about it often, but the moving to the big leagues, and again, he comes in probably the worst possible year. He comes in with a bad baseball that's completely different than what he threw in Japan, and it's affected his slider and his curveball. And then, you know, with the amount of homers they're hitting, you know, he's mentioned, 1 through 9 in most orders now, you run the risk if you make a bad pitch, a guy's going to hit it out of the park. In Japan, 3 guys might be able to do that. And I think that's kind of got him away from who he is. I don't want to say he pitched afraid, but he was very cognizant of contact and what could happen. And I think once you start nibbling and all that other stuff, you get kind of, you start falling behind in counts. But I do think there were some issues with his mechanics. Teams had timed it out. I think he was tipping some pitches. But like the start in Toronto, it just looked clean. Like it looked like he was just out there throwing. He wasn't thinking about it so much. And Tom Murphy mentioned that he'd just gotten so, you know, trying to place the ball. And when he was in that last start, he just was kind of throwing it without care. And I think that's important. But, you know, the mechanical stuff is that was real. And they felt like he regressed onto it. And I don't think he did it on purpose. He just didn't know that he was doing it. It was kind of like, you know, he'd gone back to some things and just kind of fell back into a bad habit because you get out in the game, you start competing. It's probably like Jim with golf. He's probably, you know, money off the driving range, but he gets out on the course, has a couple of beers, and some things fall apart. That's kind of what happened with Kikuchi. I don't know about the beer part, but I think he got out and started competing, and it just went back to some things he'd always done, and he didn't know he was really doing that.
Yeah, well, you should have seen me at Gamble Sands. I fired a cool 81 over there, pal. All right? That's pretty good stuff.
Were you
right
playing
there.
Were you playing from the senior tees?
I was playing from the white tees. Yeah.
He also played 54 holes, was that 2 weeks ago? Although it was with a cart, and 18 of those were a putting course.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, Ryan, we'll let you get back to the poodle dog.
I've never been to the pool dog for a living down here in the South End. You should come down though sometime and hang out, Daniel. I'll take you some good places around here.
All right, that is Ryan Divish. Thanks, Ryan. Thank you very much. We appreciate him. You can read his dispatches in the Seattle Times. Coming up next, Bobby Wagner has an idea about why some guys tend to leave Seattle on less than ideal terms. That's next.
This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
This hour, Danny, Dave, and Moore brought to you by Parsons Extreme Golf. Wyman just saw a response I had to somebody who texted in explaining to me that something of mine, he said, your
what? List.
Your list. Stinks, only he didn't use the word stinks, but he spelled it Y-O-U apostrophe R-E. So I responded, so does your grammar. Only I did your in all capitals and spelled it correctly.
Remember the Elway dog pound story where I corrected the guy at a big sign. It said, Elway, your dog meat, but it was Y-O-U-R.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let him know.
It's like, hey, dummy. You spelled that wrong.
Bobby Wagner was on with Brock and Salk this morning, and he was asked something that, honestly, I've had several friends ask me, which is, why do guys, when they leave the Seahawks, tend to be so mad? Whether it's Earl flipping the bird, whether it's Sherman kind of going on a little bit of his own explanations and discussions and wanting revenge against the Seahawks. To even what was there was story
Michael
about,
Bennett
talking about reading books during Pete's meetings, all of those different things. Why do guys when they leave here, which Pete's credited with being a coach that players like to play for, why does it seem like they're more antagonistic toward him than guys who leave Belichick, who's known as someone who's a very demanding, kind of caustic, sarcastic kind of coach? Here was Wagner's explanation.
It's like if you're with somebody for a long time and then it doesn't work out and you have to leave, majority of the time it's not going to be on like good terms, because you're going to be frustrated that you have to leave, because there's so many different things that come into play. When we're talking specifically in the league, it's like you're not the only one that has to leave Seattle. It's your family. You have to leave your friends. You have to leave all these different people. So you have to answer questions from your kids. Why do they have to give up their family and things of that nature? So when you have all of that, that's not positive energy. So when you get asked about the situation, you're not going to say, like, oh, man, it's the best thing that ever happened to me, because you still want to be there.
I guess I would say that doesn't explain specifically, because it's that way everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your family has to get uprooted and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I would think it's kind of funny. I was wondering that, too. But really, it's only three guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Marshawn, does he fall in that category? Has he? What did Marshawn say?
He's never said anything. It's just like, everybody kind of knows he's mad.
Yeah. I feel like he was going to be mad no matter where he is. And that's what Bobby's point is. I'd say this, though. It's a good place to be. You know, it's a really good place to be. And you talk to guys that have played at other franchises. It's still the way, like, when I played, I always tell the story about Detroit and how they had the weight room and a racquetball court. You had to go through one of those little doors to get there. And I came here, and they have a state-of-the-art weight room. And it's even way more upgraded now. I mean, all the things you get here, I mean, you've had success. I mean, how many years of double-digit wins and playoff appearances? Was it seven? I mean, you're kind of spoiled and you're happy here, and so you're probably going to be more mad when you're leaving a good place than a bad place, right?
I could see that. I think there's also something to it, though. My explanation has always been that, well, two things. The first is that Pete empowers people to express themselves, that guys who play here don't feel as hesitant to say what's on their mind as players in other places. They haven't been beaten down. Like, guys coming out of New England know they're not supposed to say anything. I think the other part of it is that because Pete has a more personal connection with people and with his players, and he talks about being a relationship-based coach, that I think when the relationship ends, it's more hurtful in some ways. Because it's not just strictly a professional, hey, you go out there and you're my widget who plays this role on this defense.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Like, it's more personal, so yeah. I think it might hurt more.
I'm sure that Belichick doesn't make things personal, right? And so that's why you expect, like he's been telling you, so you think, oh, that was all BS, right? That, you know, we're a family and everything, and now you're not paying me, or you're cutting me, or you're trading me, or whatever. So, yeah, and I'm sure Bill Belichick, I don't think anybody ever said, wow, Bill's such a great players coach and just love him. We have a great relationship.
Well, and we're talking about three players. Who are we talking about? Sherman, Bennett, and Earl Thomas. And what do they all have in common? They're great players, but they can also be jerks. So that might enter into it, too.
That's interesting.
Well, seriously, I mean, come on. I mean, flip. I don't care. I mean, Earl Thomas flipping off the sideline, and whether it was Pete Carroll, John Schneider, you know, and Bennett talking about, oh, God, I got to read the book, you know, because it's so boring. I've heard all this crap before. Forget. And Richard Sherman, everything that, I mean, they drafted him in the fifth round. Dave told us how crummy he was as a cornerback at Stanford. And, like, it was so horrible for him. And so we're just going to take shots on the way out. So, yeah, they're jerks. Okay? Is it all right to say that? I suppose I did. I mean, that's how I feel about him. So there you have it.
It's Danny David Moore. We got the Professor John Clayton coming up next.